the earnings, health, the economic environment, the political system, neighbors, family, and what effect does happiness have on earnings, health, and the political system? A prodigious contributor to that literature is Carol Graham, who has now assembled a masterful review of the subject. So Carol is both masterful and masterly, and I once had a long argument with an editor on the meaning of those two words. Alan Krueger is Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the U.S. Department of Treasury. Happiness for Alan Krueger are jobs numbers that are finally going in the right direction. Congratulations. Wow. He was confirmed by the Senate, a miracle these days, on May 6, 2009. He advises Secretary Geithner on all aspects of economic policy, including a very, very long list. He is currently on leave from Princeton University, where he is Benheim Professor of Economics and Public Affairs. And he has held a joint appointment in the economics department and at the Woodrow Wilson School. Eduardo Lora is a native of Colombia. He is the chief economist and general manager of the research department at the Inter-American Development Bank. He received his master's from London School of Economics, was a visiting researcher at Oxford. Before joining the bank, he served for 5 years as executive director of Fedesarrollo, how did I do? Fedesarrollo, one of the most important research centers in Latin America, and he has written also a long number of books. And Karen Dinan, we are proud to say, is our vice president and co-director of the Economic Studies program at Brookings. She decided to take that job at the very bottom of the economy so she can claim credit for all the improvement since. I guess you could say the same. She came here from the Federal Reserve Board, where she worked for 17 years, most recently as a senior advisor. She was on the White House Council of Economic Advisors from 2003 to 2004. She received her PhD. I'm sorry, I didn't do everybody's education here. She received her PhD in economics from Harvard, her BA from Brown University, where I'm told all the students are happy. So it explains how her mood today. Carol, it is a joy to be your friend, and it is a blessing to all of us that you wrote this book, and now you will tell us all how to be happy.
Okay, well, first of all, EJ, thank you very much for all the introductions. And one thing I do have to say about this book, I know it's a disappointment. I get a lot of calls from reporters saying, is this a self-help book? And I'm afraid it isn't a book that tells you how to be happy. But it is a book that's looked at, it summarizes about 10 years of research where I've been studying the determinants of happiness around the world in countries as diverse as the U.S. and China and Chile and Afghanistan. In fact, we just finished the first study of happiness in Afghanistan about 6 months ago. And one of the things that's really remarkable is how stable some of the major determinants of happiness are across countries and cultures of very, very different development levels. So I'll talk a little bit about that briefly, but I wanted to say a little bit about happiness economics, which is a kind of a new area in economics. It was very much at the fringes about 10 years ago. In fact, I wrote a book on happiness for Brookings about 10 years ago that did not get much attention at all. In fact, the then director of economic studies, who was a great friend and colleague of mine, said, Carol, this is a great manuscript, but you have to take happiness out of the title because nobody's going to take you seriously. Needless to say, I refused, and the book didn't do all that well either. But but anyway, so happiness economics in general is an approach that allows us to study, on the one hand, what makes people happy or unhappy, but also to kind of, at least in orders of magnitude terms, look at the relative effects of different things. So we can measure the unhappiness effects of unemployment or a divorce, the effects of commuting time and smoking. Are Republicans or Democrats happier? Republicans are. I can tell you why later. Are happier people healthier? The answer is yes, but healthier people are also happier. The causality seems to run in both directions. Do happier people earn more money? The answer to that is also yes. And then what are the unhappiness effects of the current crisis in the U.S.? A whole range of questions we can try and answer with these surveys. And why and how can we do that? Well, happiness economics departs from traditional or mainstream approaches in economics with one major thing. We actually listen to what people say. Standard economic approaches basically say you cannot listen to the data in surveys, you can't. It's not credible data because there's no trade-off or no consequence to people say what people say. You have to look at their consumption choices because they make real trade-offs. And that approach has served economics very well in terms of answering a range of questions, but there's some kinds of questions that it doesn't answer well. And I focus on two sets of those. One is the welfare effects of macro or institutional arrangements individuals can't change. So think about a poor peasant in Bolivia who's made unhappy by inequality or by macroeconomic volatility. Well, he or she just doesn't have the agency to reveal a preference, short of emigrating or protesting, that can demonstrate the welfare effects of that kind of arrangement. And there are a number of other scenarios like that where people don't have the agency to express their, to reveal their preferences in a way that shows whether an institutional arrangement has welfare effects or not. So there are lots of times when individuals are just powerless to reveal their preferences. But we can use well-being surveys to get at the welfare effects of those institutional arrangements. And then another set of questions that revealed preferences don't answer very well are behaviors that are not explained by optimal rational choices, but by addiction norms or self-control problems. So think about the well-being effects of smoking. There's a great study by John Gruber and Sandil Mullanathan that shows that cigarette taxes make smokers happier in Canada. That doesn't seem to make sense, at least not from a traditional economics perspective. But if you think about smoking as a self-control problem, then you could see why that might be the case. Obesity is an area where I've done some work, and we find, on average, the obese are much less happy than the non-obese. That's in addition to the health effects. Well, a standard economics approach would say, you know, consumption choices are a revealed preference. If that's the case, then why, if people are over-consuming, are they less happy? Again, we can get at that through happiness surveys in a way that we couldn't through standard revealed preferences approaches. And then finally, if you think about behaviors that are driven by norms, take somebody in a lower caste in India who doesn't choose to send his or her child to school. Because the norm is so strong that the kid is not going to get out of that caste, one could understand that choice or lack of choice in a way that a revealed preference approach wouldn't allow you. So I've been using these surveys to look at the well-being effects of a whole host of institutional arrangements on people across countries in different development levels. But in addition to being a great survey instrument, happiness has started to enter the policy domain, for good or for bad. I think there's some real questions there that I'll try and speak to. There are a lot of efforts to develop national well-being indicators as a complement to GDP data so that we could look at across countries and within countries over time, how is well-being doing? How do the well-being effects of health, marriage, employment, and all these other things vary across countries? Do they change over time? Could we complement GNP data with these measures? And this isn't just at the margins. In the British government, there's an office devoted to the development of national well-being indicators. There's some serious discussion of this in the U.S. Most recently, I'm sure a lot of you have heard of the Sarkozy Commission, which was chaired by two Nobel Prize winners and commissioned by the President of France, which called for the development of broader well-being indicators worldwide. It raised the question, should we be pursuing happiness rather than economic growth as a policy objective? Well, some of the main criticisms of this report came from the conservatives in this country basically saying this is all a plot by the French to make us have a sclerotic economy like the French and not have growth as an objective. I'll leave that to you and come back to it at the end. But I don't think that was the purpose of the Sarkozy Commission. But there are some trade-offs if one thinks about broader dimensions of well-being versus economic growth. So in short, happiness studies have gone from being at the fringes to being at the mainstream of lots of economics debates. And one of the most important is a major and renewed debate over a key relationship in economics, which is that between happiness and welfare on the one hand and income on the other. And so there's something called the Easterlin paradox, which was discovered or noticed by Richard Easterlin, the first economist to look seriously at happiness, at least in this century, about 25 years ago. And he found that if he looked across countries and over time, that average happiness levels did not increase as average GDP rates went up. So a stark example was Japan, where incomes quintupled in 3 decades, but average happiness levels actually fell. the U.S. over several decades of very rapid growth, and happiness levels remained flat. So there's been a lot of debate about this paradox. If you look at this chart, it's probably too small to see, but there's clearly the wealthier countries, the developed countries, are at further to the top, where happiness levels are higher. Happiness is on the vertical axis, and per capita GDP is on the horizontal axis, and the developing countries are slightly lower down, but only slightly. And if you look among the countries, there isn't really a clear pattern between happiness and income. So the U.S. is the wealthiest country in this particular chart, but certainly not the happiest. The Netherlands is scoring much higher on this chart, as is Canada and many others. And if you look at the Latin American countries, this is pre-crisis Argentina, by far the wealthiest country, certainly not the happiest, and a lot of very small, poor, unequal countries like Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, Venezuela, all scoring very high on happiness. There's a large debate about this. Some of it depends on which happiness question is used. With an open-ended happiness question, which the original Easterlin study was done, happiness and per capita income correlate much less closely than with a new question, well, it's actually an old question, but a question that's now used in the Gallup World Poll, which is called the best possible life question. It's closely related to happiness, but it asks respondents, imagine what's the best possible life you can imagine? How does your life compare to that life? And that introduces a relative component. And we find that answers to that question correlate more closely with both individual income and with average average GDP per capita than do open-ended happiness questions. The most extreme example I have of that is the work we did in Afghanistan, where Afghans are happier than the world average on an open-ended happiness question. They also were more likely to smile yesterday than were Cubans and Latin Americans, and yet they score much lower than the world average on the best possible life question, which suggests that when you ask them about their lives in relative terms, they're realistic, but just generally, in general terms, they're quite happy. So this kind of cross-country average happiness level relationship is a subject of much debate now. I would actually argue that while it's an interesting debate, there's a lot in these cross-country averages that is just determined by cultural differences in the way people answer surveys. We were talking before about sort of a healthy French curmudgeonliness as they answer these surveys, and there's kind of a Caribbean cheerfulness that's captured in these average country comparisons, as are unobservable differences across countries that relate to income but may vary. So richer countries in general have more freedom, more democracy, and better public goods, but there's variance across countries in how society value those things, and that's effect that comes up in their happiness responses. I think more robustly is what we can see when we compare happiness across individuals, across countries, within countries, and then we can control for the country that they live in. And then we find incredibly stable patterns in what determines happiness across the world. So here is one of the most robust relationships, for those of you that can actually see this. It's a relationship between happiness and age. It's a U-shaped curve. This is controlling for health, for your health status, and also for remaining in a stable partnership. What we find is that those of you who thought your 20s and 30s were it, you're all wrong. Happiness levels actually fall till about the mid to late 40s. I won't tell you how close to that exact point I am. But then after that, people actually get happier as they age, and one could argue they get monotonically happier until they die. So what explains this relationship? Well, one thing is there's an expectations aligning with reality effect. As people hit their mid to late 40s, they figure out what they're going to be when they grow up, and they start to deal with it. The low point in the U may also be explained by it's often a time of dependent children and dependent parents, for example. All kinds of things about the middle age years make sense. And as people get older, they may get more philosophical. There are a couple of other things going on here. There may be a selection bias because happier people live longer, so the less happy people are dying off as people age. And finally, one could argue that our oldest respondent, this is for my Latin America sample, was 99, and one could argue there may be a senility effect, but we don't know. But in any event, this relationship holds in Latin America, the U.S., Europe, Central Asia. It just held in Afghanistan, in Africa. It's incredibly robust. What else is consistent across individuals, across countries? Well, income does matter to people's happiness. Everywhere we study it, wealthier people are on average happier than poorer ones, but that relationship gets mediated by lots of other things. As people have enough money, then other things start to matter, like how much money their neighbors have. So you take two people of the same income level, and the one that lives in a wealthier neighborhood is actually less happy than the one that lives in a poorer neighborhood because of relative income effects. So the income-happiness relationship exists, but it's a fairly complicated one, particularly as people get wealthier. Health is incredibly important to people's happiness. Everywhere we've studied happiness, health matters to happiness. As I mentioned, healthier people are happier, and happier people are also typically healthier. Employment matters a great deal. Everywhere we've studied happiness, people who are unemployed are less happy than the average, even in contexts where they have full income replacement. So there's something about being employed that's beyond the income, that has to do with purpose in life and other things that really matters to people's happiness. Friendships matter a great deal to people's happiness. We found in Latin America a study that Eduardo Lora and I worked on together that after having enough food to eat, the most important thing to people's happiness in Latin America was having a friend or family member you could rely on in a time of need. Now, one interpretation of this is, oh, it's the social Latin Americans. I'm from Peru. I can say this without criticizing my fellow region, but people in my region. But basically, I think it's well beyond that. If you think about Latin America, it's a region where there aren't stable safety nets and social insurance systems. So having friends and family members you can rely on at a time of need is incredibly important to people's happiness. So these consistent patterns that we find in terms of the determinants of happiness across countries and over time allow us then to look at the effects of things that vary. Things that I mentioned before, commuting time, the quality of the environment, the inflation or the unemployment rate, the nature of governance, obesity rates, crime and corruption rates, cigarette smoking, exercise, all kinds of things. We can study how these things vary across populations. So to some extent, if I could stop right now without talking anymore, I would be very happy, and I'd say this is a great approach, and we can just measure all these things, and the world is our oyster. And to some extent, that's true. But there is one major complication, or a fly in the ointment, so to speak, and that's adaptation. People seem to be able to adapt to high levels of adversity, poor health, and all kinds of things, and retain their natural cheerfulness or their natural happiness. As I mentioned, people in Afghanistan are as happy as Latin Americans and happier than the world average, even though if you think about objective conditions in Afghanistan, it's sort of unimaginable. Another thing from the study Eduardo and I did together that he'll tell you a little bit more about, Guatemalans are more satisfied with their health care than are Chileans, even though Chilean health standards are at about U.S. levels and Guatemalan standards are at about sub-Saharan Africa levels. And Kenyans are as satisfied with their health as are Americans. I mentioned obese people are less happy than the average, but the unhappiness effects of obesity are mediated by how much obesity there is in your cohort. So if you're in a high obesity cohort, you're less bothered by being obese, you adapt to a different health norm, and you're less unhappy. The same goes for unemployment. So people who are unemployed with more unemployed people around them are less unhappy. Now, standard economics would say this doesn't make any sense. The probability that they'll be reemployed is much lower, but there's less stigma. There are more unemployed people around you, a higher unemployment norm, and you're less unhappy. So, and then another one is crime and corruption. So most places we study being a victim of crime or corruption, we find that it makes people unhappy. If you were a victim of crime or corruption in the past year, there's an unhappiness effect. But that effect is mediated by how much crime and corruption there is. So if you're a crime or corruption victim in a context where there's a lot of crime and corruption, you're much less bothered by it. And I'll give you two examples of this. The most extreme is from Afghanistan. So we find there that crime and corruption victims are not made unhappy at all by being crime and corruption victims because there's so much crime and corruption. It's just, you know, whatever. But there's one exception, and that is in Taliban-influenced districts where we were able to interview. These aren't the very extreme districts, but there's more Taliban influence than in other districts, and there are lower crime and corruption rates. And if you're a corruption victim in those districts, there is an unhappiness effect because there's much more stigma attached to it. Another example is just from my own experience. About 10 years ago, I woke up, waved goodbye to my kids, went out and got in my car to drive to work in Northwest D.C. Car wouldn't go anywhere. I was furious. I was in a hurry. Probably had to give a speech at Brookings. Couldn't get there. Got out of my car, and it was on four blocks. The tires had been stolen. Now, this doesn't happen in Northwest D.C. So, I mean, this ruined my day. I was absolutely outraged. Couldn't get over it. It took me weeks to get over this experience. If it had happened in Lima, where I grew up, Lima, Peru, I would have said, you idiot, why did you leave the car out all night? You knew the tires would get stolen, right? Same perfect, very different norms, and therefore different happiness or unhappiness effects of the experience. So people really can adapt to adversity. They also adapt to prosperity. And as I thought about this around the world and how it aggregated up across societies, I thought, well, it's probably really good from an individual psychological perspective that people are able to adapt to adversity and maintain their natural cheerfulness. But it may also result in collective tolerance for bad equilibrium. You know, if you get used to these high crime and corruption norms or poor health norms and you're happy with them, it could end up in sort of a bad collective tolerance equilibrium. And one of the things that suggests that this might be the case is that the one thing people really have a hard time adapting to is uncertainty. So people are better able to adapt to unpleasant certainty than they are to uncertainty, even uncertainty that's associated with progress. So let me give you a couple quick examples and then wrap up. In the health arena, people are better able to adapt to mobility problems and, you know, go back to their natural happiness level than they are to conditions associated with uncertainty, such as pain, anxiety, or uncontrolled epilepsy. And the very, very stark differences in the well-being effects of these conditions. In the economics arena, people adapt very quickly to income gains, and at the same time, they don't seem to like the uncertainty and reward shifts, and at times the inequality that are associated with things like rapid economic growth, which is obviously associated with progress. We've called this the paradox of unhappy growth across countries. People controlling for their own incomes are less happy in faster-growing countries. Eduardo is going to talk a little bit more about this. And at the micro level, I found something called the happy peasant and frustrated achiever problem, which is when comparing people moving in and out of poverty, we actually find that a higher percentage of the people that have large income gains moving from poverty out of poverty are less happy than are people that just stayed the same, you know, sort of stayed with stable income levels, even though much lower income levels and more subjective conditions. And let me give you a last example about adaptation, and that this is from some new work I've been doing with Soumya Chattopadhyay, who's sitting right here working the slides, based on a daily data set from Gallup that follows Americans. It's 1,000 Americans a day, a nationally representative sample, from January of 08 until the present, with all kinds of information about their socioeconomics, their employment status, their health, and all kinds of other things. But we tracked here average happiness levels in the U.S. compared to the Dow Jones Industrial Average as the crisis set on and then abated. And remember, these are on average. If we were to speak about the happiness of particular precarious cohorts, you'd get a different curve. But what we found is that happiness levels fell dramatically along with the Dow, sort of tracking the drops in the market. And you have to remember that average national happiness levels typically don't change very much at all. They just don't move very much. So these movements are large. But then in about March of or April of 09, about the end of March of 09, when the bottom stopped falling out of the markets, the uncertainty abated, and the Dow sort of sputters up but doesn't go up that much, average happiness levels go way up. And, in fact, were higher at the end of 09 than they were at the beginning of the crisis. The same respondents report that their economic situation today is worse than it was before. So this isn't a Pollyanna effect. This is people saying they have less, but they're reporting that they're happier. So they've adapted to a new, if less pleasant, certainty and returned and even surpassed their previous happiness levels. So there's a lot of adaptation across all kinds of domains, across all kinds of people. And as I said, it may be a good thing, but I think it poses some challenges. And it particularly poses some challenges when we think about these measures as policy instruments or in the policy domain. And just a couple of points about happiness and policy. I think this approach has a lot that can contribute to the policy debate, but I think we have to solve some unresolved questions before we go further. One is that the open-ended and undefined nature of happiness surveys is what makes them such a good research tool and allows for comparability across cultures and countries. So we don't define happiness for our respondents. It's the first question open-ended in a survey. So we're not imposing a Chilean definition of happiness on Chinese people or an American definition of happiness on Afghans, right? They define it for themselves. But the definition of happiness, in my view, does matter if we think about it as a policy objective. So there's happiness as contentment in the Benthamite sense, the kind of happy peasant definition of happiness. And then there's happiness as in the Aristotelian sense, right? The happiness is the opportunity to lead a fulfilling life. Maybe our frustrated achievers are frustrated because they're trying to lead a fulfilling life or get a fulfilling life or make a fulfilling life possible for their children. But the process of getting there is actually producing unhappiness in the short term. That leads me to a second unresolved problem, which is that of intertemporal problems. What matters? Is it happiness today versus the happiness of our children tomorrow? And there's some objectives that are necessary to achieve happiness in the long term or better aggregate welfare levels in the long term, like reducing our fiscal deficits. I'm sure Alan could talk about that and the unhappiness that produces, reforming our healthcare system, or even defeating the Taliban. These are all objectives that don't bring happiness to mind, at least not today, but they're objectives that we pursue at some vague level to increase the welfare and well-being and possibly happiness of large numbers of people in the long term. So these are all questions I think that we still need to have a debate about as we think about whether or not happiness surveys and the results of happiness surveys are instruments that we can introduce into the policy debate. But having unanswered questions is what makes this both a really rewarding research area to be in. It's a nascent science. We don't have all the answers yet. But I think we have a lot more to learn. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Having unanswered questions creates a need for more social science research, which creates employment for social scientists, which makes them happy. I just want to make two notes. One is you've got to get Carol talking about this aspect, which has always fascinated me, that the happiness levels of couples drops when their children become teenagers. And I've thought about this a lot. Two of my kids are teenagers, and one is almost a teenager, and I'm pretty happy, which makes me think either my kids are very good or I am completely out of touch and ignorant, maybe all three. And the other is Alan will prove to me that he was an economist, because when Carol said, "We get happier until we die," and then Alan whispered to me, "Then we have no more data." So I turned to Alan next.
That's it. That's let me say I'm very happy to be on this panel, especially on a day when E.J. Dionne wrote such a courageous piece in the Washington Post about tax day. When Carol invited me to participate in this panel, she said, and I quote, "I know you are busy on your job, so you don't have to read my book to participate." But I have taken the time to read the book, and I wanted to start by praising Carol for performing careful research and tackling such a difficult subject. I was particularly impressed by the careful comparison of the determinants of well-being measures across countries and by her analysis of unemployment. Some economists have questioned why policymakers are so focused on reducing the effects of recessions when, according to their models, business cycle fluctuations have relatively small effects on society's welfare, especially in comparison to supply-side policies that, in their models, spur long-run growth. But the severe, persistent, and universal adverse effects of unemployment on psychological well-being that Carol documents in her book provide a convincing reason why policymakers are right to use both microeconomic and macroeconomic policies to reduce the level of unemployment and mitigate its effects for the unemployed. And I would add, while I agree with Carol that adaptation is a fairly pervasive phenomenon, one of life's events that people do have difficulty adapting to is unemployment. So that's yet another reason for focusing on reducing unemployment as quickly as possible in the aftermath of a crisis like the one that we've gone through. The book has quite broad analysis in it, and in fact, I think the title and subtitle misrepresent the content. The title, Happiness Around the World, is much too limiting. The book is really about subjective well-being, which is a broader concept that encompasses happiness as part of it. I also don't think there is a paradox of a happy peasant and miserable millionaires, as the subtitle asserts. The data fairly clearly, as Carol mentioned, indicate that within countries, the millionaires, or at least those with higher income, report higher levels of happiness than those with lower incomes. The paradox seems to me to be that people think that becoming rich will raise their happiness and reduce their sadness by much more than is actually the case. Not that income actually has no effect or a negative effect on happiness, and I'll return to that. I'll focus my remarks on two topics, the Easterlin paradox and issues of measurement. These are exciting times for the Easterlin paradox, or as I now prefer to call it, the Easterlin hypothesis. So as Carol mentioned, Easterlin argued that when countries become wealthier, their levels of happiness don't increase. Using Gallup World Poll data at the country level, my Princeton colleague Angus Deaton showed that the ladder of the best possible life that Carol mentioned before increases with the logarithm of income, or even a little bit faster for rich countries. Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers in a Brookings paper found that life satisfaction and the ladder of life have about the same upward sloping relationship with income across people within a country as they do across countries with different levels of average income. They also found that the growth in income across countries is associated with an increase in the growth of happiness that is about the same magnitude as they found in levels, although their estimates are fairly imprecise here. I commented on the Stevenson and Wolfers paper here a little over a year ago, and one of the things that struck me when they provided their data to me is that the relationship between income growth and changes in happiness varies considerably across countries. And Carol alluded to this, how cultural factors, other factors, perhaps mediate the relationship between income and happiness. Some countries seem much more adept at converting income growth into higher levels of happiness than other countries. The U.S., as I'm sure we're most interested, seems to have had fairly modest changes in reported life satisfaction or measures of happiness, despite growing GDP in the last 40 years. In part, the weak relationship between GDP growth and life satisfaction in the U.S. could be due to the very uneven distribution of the gains in income that we've seen. In part, it could be due to the phenomenon of diminishing marginal utility of income. And I suspect part of it also has to do with the fact that the increases in income that we've seen have not been used to reduce work hours. Carol Graham extends the past work on the Easterlin hypothesis by examining Gallup's World Poll and several other data sets for a number of countries. She also emphasizes the role of income growth on the level of happiness. She interprets the negative effect of income growth on happiness as evidence of an aspiration treadmill. Aspirations increase so much in fast-growing societies that a higher income does not lead to higher levels of life satisfaction or happiness. I'm not so sure that this is the right interpretation of that relationship, however, as I think it would be more appropriate to have the change in happiness or the ladder of life as the outcome measure to reach this conclusion. Rather than the level of happiness. Indeed, as I'll explain, I think the evidence in the book and elsewhere suggests surprisingly little support for an aspiration treadmill. Carol notes that the different measures of well-being have different relationships with income. The book interprets this as framing. I would put it differently. Framing is a tendency for the way the same question is posed to elicit different responses. Asking about where people stand on a possible ladder of life and whether they smiled yesterday are not the same question. They address fundamentally different concepts. The ladder of life or life satisfaction are evaluative questions about people's lives overall. Questions about smiling relate to people's affect or mood, how they felt at a particular time. Being in a cheerful mood is not the same thing as being satisfied with one's life as a whole, or feeling that one lives in the best possible world. Moreover, I think that measures of the concept of overall life evaluation and those that measure the concept of moment-to-moment feelings are subject to different biases in the way we measure them. Likewise, I suspect that the evaluations of one's life overall are more prone to aspirational effects than our moment-to-moment feelings. So the fact that Carolyn in this book, as well as Stevenson and Wolfers, find the stronger effect of income on where people place themselves on the ladder of life or on life satisfaction than on measures that are more closely aligned to moment-to-moment feelings, like smiling or feeling happy or feeling sad, strikes me as evidence against an aspiration treadmill. The interesting question is, why does income have a stronger effect on more general evaluations of life overall than on moment-to-moment feelings? This brings me to the focusing illusion. The focusing illusion is a tendency for people to focus on a few salient features of a situation in evaluating it. Psychologists have found that people tend to overemphasize these features in making decisions. And I suspect this is part of the reason why we can't always trust revealed preference, while people's choices don't necessarily reveal what makes them best off or what raises their level of well-being most. For example, my colleagues Danny Kahneman and David Cicotti did a study where they asked people in Minnesota to report whether they believe people in California are happier than they themselves are. Now, you might reflect on that for a moment, and you might think a little bit about the weather in California and the weather in Minnesota. There's a natural tendency to focus on the weather when thinking of the well-being of Californians and Minnesotans. The Minnesotans strongly believed the Californians were happier. In fact, other surveys show there's no difference in self-reported happiness between those living in California and those in Minnesota. Now, other things, if you reflect on it a bit further, matter tremendously for people's happiness, which have nothing to do with the weather. But the Minnesotans ignored the smog, congestion, and daily hassles of life that affect happiness and instead focused on the weather and answering the question. A study that I did together with Kahneman and Cicotti that we published in Science found a similar result for income. We asked a representative sample. Think of someone who makes less than $20,000 a year or someone who makes more than $100,000 a year. How much time do you think they spend in a bad mood? Respondents on average predicted that the lower income group spent 58% of their time in a bad mood, whereas other data we collected, where we had people keep time diaries as they went about their business, suggested that people in the low income group below $20,000 a year actually spent 32% of their time in a bad mood. On the other hand, respondents predicted that the higher income group would spend 26% of their time in a bad mood, and the evidence we collected suggested that they actually spent about 20%. So the implicit effect of income on spending time in a bad or good mood in this study was overestimated by 20 percentage points. People thought income mattered a lot more for people's mood than appears to have been the case. When people are asked about their own life satisfaction, or to locate themselves on a ladder of life, they're likely to focus on their economic conditions and partly use that as a handle in providing an answer. The exercise that well-off respondents go through is probably something like, I'm a fortunate person, I have a high-paying job, I have a big house and an expensive car, I should report myself as satisfied with my life or on a high step in the ladder of best possible lives. Likewise, when asked in an international survey to place themselves on an imagined 0 to 10 ladder, ranging from the worst possible to best possible life, someone is likely to think about whether they live in a rich or a poor country and choosing their rung on the ladder. This tendency is less likely to affect people's moment-to-moment feelings than it is to affect their overall evaluation of their life. If people are asked in real time whether they are happy or sad or whether they feel anger or pain, they are more likely to report their feelings without going through a filter of focusing on the salient aspects of their life situation or without thinking about how they should feel relative to some aspirational level. This leads me to think that reported life satisfaction or the ladder of life is more likely to be affected by the focusing illusion and aspirations than our questions about moment-to-moment feelings. Another advantage of moment-to-moment feelings is that people's subjective well-being could be connected to the activities they are engaged in at the time they report their feelings. So as Carol mentioned, her work and other work suggests that having friends is extremely important for people's overall happiness level and well-being. One could look at how do people report their feelings when they're with friends versus in other situations. I should acknowledge I was a member of the Sarkozy Commission that proposed additional measures of well-being, including using what we call national time accounting, trying to classify the types of activities people engage in and how they feel during those activities. So I would conclude by saying that the field should focus on measuring dimensions of subjective well-being rather than a single open-ended concept of happiness. I realize this is very difficult to do across countries, but the Gallup World Poll, which has questions specifically on feeling sad or feeling angry or feeling in pain, which I should also confess I helped design for them, offer a new opportunity in a cross-country setting, and hopefully they'll also provide time series data so we could look at changes over time. Another opportunity that I wanted to mention in the U.S. is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has added a module on well-being to the American Time Use Survey starting this year, and this will provide information on people's emotional states during periods of the day, as well as the information they already collect on the activities that people are engaged in and who they're spending time with and so on. I think that one of the key questions in this literature is why some countries apparently are subject to an Easterlin paradox and others are not. Unraveling this paradox will require more refined data and analysis within individual countries, as Carol emphasized, and I think Carol's book provides a very good start on this agenda.
Thank you very much. I hope the Tea Party folks don't decide that that survey is government intrusion on people's unhappiness. It would be a terrible terrible thing. And thank you. That was very kind of you on my column today. I wrote a column guaranteed to make everybody unhappy this morning. I praise the Internal Revenue Service and the men and women who work there on April 15th. So I've gotten a few. Most of the positive responses came from Alan and from people who work for the Internal Revenue Service. But I knew I felt something for Mr. Laura. He also writes a column for the Colombian magazine Dinero, which is, sounds like a wonderful magazine on economics. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, but I usually talk about happiness rather than dinero.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks to Brookings and the organizers of this event for this kind invitation. I suppose that the reason why I'm here is because I've written or co-edited a book with Carol Graham. It's something that we published a couple of months ago. And it was a joint publication of Brookings and the Inter-American Development Bank. So I have a double appreciation for Brookings for inviting me and also for publishing this book that we wrote together. And I hope that this will be the first of a series of publications, joint publications between the two institutions. Last week, a group of distinguished academic economists, including several Nobel Prize winners, gathered at King's College, Cambridge. You must have read about this in the press, to discuss the lessons of the global financial crisis for our profession. One of the central conclusions, and here I quote the Financial Times, was that economists and market traders alike need to devote far more time to human psychology rather than just the raw economic numbers below of many policy wonks. Or as George Soros, the hedge fund investor who sponsored the meeting, put it very starkly, economic phenomena involve thinking participants. The problem is that those participants don't think in a way that represent reality, which is very remarkable. I mean, especially coming from such an observer as George Soros, and especially in that context when they were discussing what to do about our profession in the wake of the financial crisis. These are precisely the premises of the so-called happiness science that we have been talking about. The book that edited by Carol and me showcases a collection of research papers that explore how people's perceptions and expectations affect the way they value the quality of their lives. Our book is focused mainly in Latin America, although compares Latin America with other regions, but our focus is basically Latin America. And we have found a number of surprises, at least for those who expect that people's thoughts and impressions should reflect reality or some type, at least, of economic rationality. A good example is how people judge the quality of their health and the health systems of the country, something that Carol alluded to already. Surprisingly, their judgments have nothing to do with their life expectancy or with any other standard indicator of health outcomes. They do not even have to do with health expenditures. For instance, health satisfaction in the U.S. is no greater than in South Africa or in Kenya, where life expectancies are around 45 years. In the Americas, Guatemala, which is one of the poorest countries in the region, is one of the countries with the highest health satisfaction, while Chile is the one with the lowest health satisfaction, exactly the opposite of what you would expect on the basis of any objective indicator. If we take a different area, education, and we make comparisons not across countries but across socioeconomic groups or individuals belonging to different socioeconomic groups within the countries, what we find is that lower socioeconomic groups have a better opinion of the educational system in the countries than higher socioeconomic groups. These findings lead to a very disturbing conclusion. People are very poor judges of the quality of public policies in general and of the quality of social policies in particular. People are often misinformed, and their judgment is influenced by a host of factors, from cultural values to aspirations or lack thereof, about what the health or the education system of a country should provide. And this is very disturbing because it makes us question the ability of open democratic systems, such as that of the U.S., to produce sensible policy reforms in these areas. Another surprising finding reported in the book is what we call the unhappy growth paradox, and Carol has already referred to this paradox already. David Brooks referred to this phenomenon in a recent op-ed in the New York Times that illustrated the complicated relationship between happiness and income. Here's the paradox. I don't know if it's the same way that has been explained already. If you take two countries with similar income levels, let's say Korea and Japan, the income level is not so big, and they share some common cultural roots. That's why it also helps for the comparison. If you take these two countries that have, as I say, similar income levels, the odds are that people in the one that grows faster, Korea in this case, is much less happy than in the other one. Okay? It's not about change comparison. It's not about comparisons in time. It's not how the Koreans were feeling 5 years ago or 10 years ago and how they are feeling now, which is what we were discussing before. Here is what happens with your feelings today when the economy today or in the past year or couple of years has been growing fast. And another example, for instance, in Latin America. As everybody knows, Chile is a fast grower and is, as has already been mentioned, is one of the least satisfied countries in every respect that you take. While Mexico, a slow grower country with about the same income level as Chile, is much happier. Why is satisfaction with life and with other aspects of life lower in fast-growing countries? That's the question that we pose in one of the chapters of the book. Apparently, it has nothing to do with the familiar story. Apparently, it has to do with the familiar story of keeping up with the Joneses. I think that's the main thing, that the main explanation that we explore. Many people, basically because many people resent that others make faster material progress than themselves. That's the main explanation that we pose. It's not, and I agree in that with the previous commentator, it's not the aspiration treadmill. It's a different thing. The aspiration treadmill is a different story. The aspiration treadmill is that I get used to what I'm consuming, while the Jonas's treadmill, let's put it that way, is that I want to have what others have. So it's different, and that explains what we call the unhappy growth paradox. An important implication of the unhappy growth paradox is that a government strategy focused entirely on economic growth has little chance of political success, given that income growth may not result in greater satisfaction with different aspects of life, especially if such income growth unequally benefits different groups of individuals, or if it substantially changes expectations of material progress. Given this, it is not surprising that Washington consensus policies have been the subject of popular rejection in Latin America, especially in the countries where the promoters of such policies tended to exaggerate the potential benefits. This doesn't mean that government should disregard growth and aim at maximizing profit and maximizing happiness. Some prominent scholars, such as Richard Layer of the LSE, are in favor of making happiness an explicit goal, if not the main goal of public policies. In the book, Carol and I disagree with this view. We believe that the search for short-run happiness would lead many governments to do things that are damaging for the progress of societies in the long run. And I think that all the commentators have referred to that already. Since many people resent that others make faster material progress than themselves, maximizing happiness could dictate some very harmful policies. For instance, to appease these feelings of envy, governments may be inclined to take measures such as expropriating successful firms. And we know of governments that do that. This is not a theoretical example that I'm presenting. Or imposing price controls or heavy taxes on a few visible activities of firms, etc. So these are examples that take place in practice when governments try to make people happy in the short run. In order to make people happy, governments may also try to reduce people's aspirations to improvements in other areas of their lives, be it health, education, or security. Obviously, conformism is not conducive to progress. So this is, I think, a very important argument of why we shouldn't think that maximizing happiness should be the objective of public policies. One of the secrets of happiness is that it cannot be attained directly. The advice of prominent psychologists such as Ed Diener is that happiness should come as a byproduct and cannot be achieved by aiming at being happy. Since John Stuart Mill, this has been known as the hedonic paradox, and I think that you referred to that in your initial quotations. The singular pursuit of happiness can make it more distant, whereas pursuing a life that is rich, engaging, and full of challenges may inadvertently bring happiness closer. Well, I think that this is true not just for individuals. This is also true for nations. I think that aiming for happiness at the country level of at the level of public policies is basically wrong, and it's something that you should aim for only indirectly through other means. Although happiness is not the right criteria to measure the progress of societies, happiness research can provide many useful insights for public policy purposes, and we have already heard several examples of that. A very simple and fascinating one is the use of life satisfaction data to value public goods. The reason is as follows. As we have heard, life satisfaction depends on income. Say if your income is double, you will probably go one rung up in the 10 rung ladder of life satisfaction that has been mentioned. Okay? You double income, you go up one rung. Now, suppose that research shows that reducing crime in a neighborhood produces the same improvement, that is, one rung up, in the level of life satisfaction of the people that live in that neighborhood. Okay? You go and do the research, and you find that after a change in the crime conditions in a neighborhood, the conditions are now better, and people are now feeling better with their lives. So what tells you this? Well, this tells you that the value of improving security is equivalent to doubling people's income, because they produce the same result in terms of life satisfaction. Since you can apply the same methodology to value many other public goods, you have a very simple way of comparing their values and of prioritizing public policy and public expenditures. This is a very simple example. Of course, there are a lot of nuances to this. It's not can be applied as simple as I have described it. But this is a very simple example of how this type of research can produce very useful and very potent implications for public policy. This is just one of many public examples, one of many examples of the usefulness of happiness data and happiness research for public policies, I am saying. There are plenty of many others in the book that we are presenting today. Well, I finish with this. Once again, my thanks to Brookings and to Carol for being such a valuable source of ideas, and to you for being here.
That last point is really fascinating. We should talk about that some more. When you talked about keeping up with the Joneses, I realized that so much of Karen's research is about unhappiness. Her recent papers are on the mortgage crisis, household indebtedness, household income volatility. But she always is such a warm and happy person. And so I was thinking it's the keeping up with the Joneses phenomenon. She knows how much trouble the Joneses are actually having. But it's actually obviously some inner spiritual happiness, because she takes no pleasure in other people's unhappiness and tries to heal it. That's why she's here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a lot to live up to. Okay. So everyone has talked about the Easterlin paradox. I'm actually not going to talk about the Easterlin paradox. But I'm going to hit on a couple of themes that I think everybody has also talked about. And one is what the government can do, what's the role of the government in promoting happiness. And the second common theme has been that everyone's mentioned the financial crisis, and I'm going to key off the financial crisis, and also to key in particular off Eduardo's point that that what we've been through over the last couple of years has really led a lot of us to rethink the premises under which we, and when I say we, I mean we economists, to rethink the premises under which we've been operating. And the theme I want to dwell on is the relationship between choice and happiness. And I'm going to cheat a little. I'm going to talk about whether more choice leads to better outcomes, because I don't have the happiness data to relate to choice. But I think pretty clearly, based on what Carol has established about the link between outcomes and happiness, I think it's fair to say that you can imply, you can think of it as, does more choice lead to more happiness? And the choices I want to talk about are related to, it's not going to be surprising given what EJ just said about my research, I want to talk about the financial decisions that households can and do make. So let me start by giving you a little background. I want to talk about trends we've observed in the financial environment facing households over the past few decades. And I'm going to key in on three major changes or trends that we've seen. And the first would be there's been a significant increase in households' ability to borrow. So technological advances have made it easier for firms to collect and disseminate information about households' credit worthiness, and they've also made it easier for them to develop new techniques to determine underwriting standards and manage risks. And these things have all increased the availability of credit. Some part of this has been reflected in an increase in the number of households who can borrow. In the early 1960s, about two-thirds of households held some sort of debt. And more recently, the number's been about three-quarters. And it's also been reflected in households who already had access to credit markets being able to take on more debt by lowering the cost of credit. So in the early 1960s, the median household had debt that amounted to about 1.5 months' worth of their income. And just prior to the financial crisis, the median household had debt that amounted to about 7 months' worth of their income. So there's been this big increase. So that's one major trend. A second major trend in household financial opportunities has been greater access to the stock market, again facilitated by technological advances that have made it easier to purchase stocks directly, but also to own stocks indirectly through things like mutual funds and other more recently developed financial products. So I don't have numbers that go back to the 1960s in this case, but 20 years ago, 32% of households, about a third, had some sort of equity holdings. And for the last 10 years, it's been about half of all households. A third major trend is the way in which we hold our retirement wealth. Households are much less likely today to have the traditional defined benefit pension plan where the employer calls the shots for you and delivers, you know, payments after you retire according to some schedule. The fraction of households with the rights to some sort of defined benefit plan has dropped from about 43% to 32% over the last two decades. And what's increased is the households' use of defined contribution pension plans. So that, those are the accounts where you call the shots, where you put the money in and maybe even decide how it's going to be invested. So the fraction of households having a defined contribution plan has risen from about 25% to 50% over the last 20 years. So, three major trends. What's the common theme here? Well, the common theme is an expansion of household financial opportunities. Households have more choices. More households have the opportunity to take on debt or invest in stocks if they think that doing so is likely to lead to a better outcome over the longer run. And with regard to the retirement savings, households no longer have to save today if they think tomorrow will be a better time to save. Rather, they can decide to wait to save, and they can decide whether the savings are going to go into lower yielding but safer accounts or whether they're going to go into higher yielding or riskier accounts. So what do we make of this expansion of household financial opportunities? Leaving aside the last few years, we can say that for the average household, there have been significant benefits. More choice has yielded better outcomes. So having access to riskier investments has allowed households on average to enjoy the substantial return premium associated with long-run holdings of those investments. And the expansion of credit has been very helpful to households in both kind of a short-run business cycle context and a longer-run life cycle context. So in terms of the business cycle, in my own research, I've found that thanks to the expansion of credit, households are better able to sustain their spending through a temporary shock to their income. So they don't have to suffer that reduction in their consumption, which will be bad for their happiness. And particularly given the discussion of norms that we've been talking about, perhaps even worse than a standard model would tell you. So the key example here would be the 2001 recession, which was kind of a traditional demand shock-driven recession. In that case, there was the Fed aggressively cut interest rates. It allowed households to take on a lot of debt. And the result was that household borrowing went up in their consumption didn't, or at least in the aggregate, it didn't fall very much, and it turned out to be a very mild recession by historical standards. There's also work showing that over the life cycle, this increase in access to credit has been good for households on average. Young households now have more capacity to buy a home that's more in line with their sort of reasonable expectations of their income over the life cycle, so they don't have to go through the cost and the energy of buying a starter home and then trading up. So there have been these substantial benefits of this expansion of opportunities, of this greater choice with regard to financial issues. But at the same time, of course, greater risk has come along with the greater choices. So for investments, it's pretty clear that, when you get into riskier investments, things don't always work out the way you thought they would. And I probably don't, given what we've been through the past couple of years, I don't need to really persuade you about that. You just don't always get the return on your risky investments at the point at which you need it, when you retire or when you're going to send your kids to college, because the market may be very bad. With respect to retirement accounts, you may be wrong that tomorrow is a bad time. It is a better time to save. On the borrowing side, the increased access to credit has substantially raised people's monthly commitments to pay. So, again, this is something you can quantify. The fraction of households with really high monthly commitments to pay, exceeding 40% of their before-tax income, that's about tripled over the last quarter century. So if your income doesn't turn out as you expected, it puts you in a riskier situation. Maybe you won't be able to make those payments, which is going to put you in a lot of trouble and impair your future access to credit. More capacity to borrow has increased risk in another important way, as some of that borrowing has translated into more investment in risky assets. So, again, over the last couple of years, the big example is housing. Households now own more housing, and what this means is that a given percent change in home prices is associated with much larger changes in wealth. So 25 years ago, a 20% decline in your home price would be the equivalent of losing 3 months' worth of income. Now it's the equivalent of losing 6 months' worth of your income. So more financial choices have both good and bad aspects for households' economic security and therefore for household happiness. And now let me get to the role of government. What can governments do? Well, governments can restrict choices through regulations. So, for example, right now we have regulations that restrict certain types of loan or certain lending practices. The authority to make those regulations is now with the Federal Reserve Board, but that's something that's being debated as part of financial reform. So we can restrict choices, but the really hard question is knowing how much of that we want to be doing. So pretty clearly, if we were to undo all of the expansion of financial opportunities over the past few decades, we could reduce risk. But then we would lose all the benefits that I just discussed about these greater opportunities. And the other thing is that we've just had an exceedingly painful lesson in how regulators are not infallible as they make their decisions about what they're going to restrict. And in my opinion, that's an issue that both policy-oriented academics and the Washington policy-making community should be very humble about right now. That said, I think it's clear that there are at least a couple of contexts in which restricting choices is clearly justified. And the first is when the average person doesn't understand the financial product, or in particular, it puts them into an unsustainable situation. Even prior to the crisis, we were seeing growing evidence that many people don't understand complicated financial products. So for example, Karen Pence and Brian Bucks at the Fed, Anna Maria Luzzardi at Dartmouth, and Peter Tufano at Harvard Business School, they've documented that some households have a lot of difficulty understanding the terms of mortgages beyond the most basic ones. So households understand if they have a fixed rate mortgage or an adjustable rate mortgage, but if they have an adjustable rate mortgage, they don't understand, or some households don't understand, how often or how much it can adjust. So that's one case in which I think the regulation is justified. And the second is when there are significant spillovers if people make the wrong choices. So the roots of the recent crisis were in a widespread mistake regarding home prices. One thing that Carol says in her book is that there's some survey evidence that people tend to have an optimistic bias about their future income, and I think this is the same sort of thing going on with home prices. People saw home prices rising very rapidly and expected them to continue to rise rapidly, and then were able to act on it thanks to easy mortgage credit. But in truth, they were getting themselves in a situation they couldn't possibly sustain if their expectations turned out not to be correct. So, in fact, of course, they did turn out to be wrong. And, it was a very painful thing for the people who had made the bad decisions. But the implications were much broader than that, of course, because it induced this credit cycle, which then brought us into this terrible recession. So when there's significant spillovers, I think it's pretty clear that the government should be getting involved. So just to wrap up, I think that choice and especially opportunity are words that are typically used by policymakers as things that contribute positively to welfare and happiness. And certainly most of us economists, we're trained to think that choice is always good. And in the context of financial decisions, I think greater opportunities, choice has many positive aspects, but we need to remember that greater choice comes with more risk. So there is a role for the government to restrict choice through regulation with the goal of allowing households to benefit from the positive aspects of an expansion of household financial opportunities while being protected from the more negative ones.
Thank you very much. I was thinking as you were talking about a conversation I had with my wife last night, and I have a couple of retirement accounts, and what I actually told her last night is I think I can open the envelopes again. I decided to let them sit there for a year, and I think I will be pleasantly surprised, and now after not seeing them for a year, and then my happiness will increase. I want to focus on three things and then bring the audience in. If I could, I think this whole question about government promoting happiness and the dangers of it, I'd love sort of Alan to reflect on Eduardo's, from your Sarkozy experience, reflecting on what Eduardo said about this enterprise. I want Carol to have a chance to answer and comment on what she's heard. And in particular, I want to sort of ask a question that might be summarized as happiness isn't what it's cracked up to be. By which I mean that from your comments and your research, there is something about low expectations that can lead to happiness. Eugene Debs once said there should be a ninth beatitude. Blessed are they who expect nothing, for they shall not be disappointed. And yet there's a problem with that. And we've talked about this before. and that, you know, unhappiness and dissatisfaction can actually lead to self-improvement, social change. And I'd love you, as somebody who's studied happiness so much, I mean, perhaps your next book could be The Limits of Happiness, but I'd just love you to reflect on this problem, whichever order we want to go in there. And also Karen coming in response to, I'd like you on this, government's role in this. Who wants to take it first? Why don't we go to Carol, since you have brought us all together.
Oh, okay. I think that's a big puzzle in the book, and it may be what I'm referring to in the subtitle, Alan, in terms of the happy peasant versus miserable millionaire problem, even though on average certainly millionaires report to be happier than peasants, but the fact that peasants are happier than their situation should predict, and millionaires are often less happy than their situation would predict. And I think it does relate to this whole issue of low expectations. And having looked at many, many countries going through economic reforms and the development process, and there are a lot of times where that process of change and progress produces unhappiness in the short term, and with hopes for longer-term benefit. And I think it's usually the case. But it raises, in my mind, it raises, one, some questions about the process. You know, is progress always an unsettling thing with uncertainty and everything else? And it also raises a huge issue about intertemporal choices. And I think a lot in terms of migrants who migrate to a city, and very quickly their reference norm becomes not their income before, but their income in the town they are, and they report to be unsatisfied with their level of income, and they're typically less happy than the average. They may have migrated to the city, though, to provide their children the opportunity to have better schools and a fulfilling life, which in the big picture of things is hopefully an objective that's related to some definition of happiness, maybe not the happiness that's reported on a day-to-day survey. And Alan has thought a lot about these different domains of happiness. Versus you go back to rural people, the people that stayed in the rural towns, and if they compare, they don't compare their situation to other people in the city or even other people in the town. They tend to compare their situation to how they were the year before. So if their harvest was okay, well, then they're okay and they're happy, but in a lower expectation sense. So I can observe that phenomenon. I'm not sure I know how to answer it as a question. You know, is there a limit to happiness? There are a lot of objectives where unhappiness comes to mind, at least in the short term, for longer term gain. And I guess what the happiness surveys do is allow us to think about those trade-offs. I don't think it suggests that we shouldn't make those trade-offs at times if the longer term objective is worth it. But they do. They force us to think about what the process of change entails in terms of well-being, at least in the short term. And I think just another very quickly an example of when you look at entire continents, Latin America, and even more starkly Eastern Europe, that underwent dramatic economic changes from the post-communist time to now, turning to the market. We know that happiness levels dropped dramatically in those contexts and then have, for the most part, at least in Eastern Europe, recovered, maybe not fully, but almost fully. But that people's satisfaction with different parts of their lives has changed. So they tend now to be more satisfied with the material sides of their lives and less satisfied with, for example, some of the non-material part of their lives. And so progress is often associated with, whether you want to call it shifting priorities or, you know, different parts of people's quality of life changing. And again, these surveys allow us to understand those phenomena. I don't think at least I can say whether or not, you know, that suggests that there's a limit to happiness, but I do think that it suggests that progress is associated with at least short-term unhappiness much of the time. I haven't answered you very well, but I haven't answered this question yet. I mean, it's sort of the question that came out of my book, not the question I can answer.
Thank you. Ellen.
A little bit of stream of consciousness in that, in the answer. I don't disagree with Carol that change can be unsettling and that change can lower happiness, even though in material terms that change might look like it's positive. Where I disagreed was interpretation of that being related to aspirations as opposed to differences in people's routines and the recognition that there are trade-offs when the world does change. And I certainly agree that uncertainty is a big issue, which is also related to change. In terms of kind of what government can do and how this influences government, that's an interesting question. One of the things I've always been struck by is we economists focus so much on GDP and income, and the politicians keep an eye on it, but they're also aware of a much broader measure of subjective well-being. You know, after all, they want to be reelected, and doing things which make their constituents want to reelect them is important to them.
By the way, if I can interrupt, that chart is one of the few pieces of data I've seen recently that would make Democrats happy thinking about the midterm elections. But, you know, when you look at that line, but go ahead.
Well, I'm sure if you reflected further, you'd think of some more more reasons.
I'm not talking about my own subjective views. I'm just talking about data.
Healthcare reform, I think, will also make them feel good. But on the Sarkozy Commission, and once I joined the administration in February of 2009, I resigned from the Sarkozy Commission, and they kind of went on their own. But what I recall is that they were focused on more than one measure. And, you know, if you're an airline pilot, you don't look at just one gauge. You have a whole bunch of gauges. And I think that's the way we ought to think about our evaluation of how society is performing, and I think to a large extent we do. Maybe GDP was too successful, and it's gotten too much emphasis compared to other measures like inequality and poverty, which are obviously important for the well-being of society. I think some of the happiness research does filter into public policy. I was thinking when Karen was talking, one good example is we know that the way that choices are framed affects people's decisions. Karen knows this literature probably better than I do. And then if you give people a default, they tend to not want to make a choice, and they'll just go with the default option. This played a role in the Pension Protection Act, where you kind of offer a plain, safe choice as the default, and then people can move away from that if they want to. Overwhelmingly, people tend to stay with the default, so choosing the default option is very important. You might think if you're involved with a for-profit financial institution on the other side, they might understand this better than the person who's making the choice and might set the default so it's not necessarily in their interest. And in a whole bunch of areas, I think the administration has thought about how do we set the default. We're not constraining people's choices, but we recognize that they tend often to go with the default. So how do we choose the default so that if they did take the time to consider and weigh the alternatives, they would recognize it was the right option. And if it's not the right option for them, then they are able to change. One of the things which is difficult in the happiness area when it comes to policy is adaptation, because people adapt to their circumstances. And at a certain level, it means you have to keep continually changing things. Otherwise, they'll adapt and they go back to where they were. So that is difficult. I'd also mention that I think the recent focus on time use and people's well-being changes the way you think about policy a little bit. For example, one of the most miserable activities people go through in their daily routine is commuting to work. And that suggests to me that we ought to take into account commuting time when we think about investment in public infrastructure. So I think here's a point to make. Another thing which could make Democrats happy is that, you know, the Recovery Act puts a lot of money into high-speed rail, into improving our highways, which should ultimately reduce commuting time. So that's a small example, and there are other reasons for investing in public infrastructure, but I think if you think about how it affects well-being, it pushes you in a particular direction.
Do you want to add to – I mean, I was curious. I found your idea very interesting about thinking about whether happiness measures were helpful in determining the distribution of public goods and what public goods you invest in. And I was wondering, in light of Alan's comments, I mean, all this research is almost like a Hallmark card. You know, your family life, your friends are as important as anything in happiness. Is that a fair, if oversimplified, summary? Or they play a very big role?
They play a big role, as long as you're not hungry or destitute.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you. You know, and I was wondering, and you were talking about commuting time and the like, there are so many public policies that might ease, you can't make people happy in their family lives, but you can ease, create circumstances in which they're going to be more happy. I'm wondering if that fits your definition of where you put public goods, whether it's commuting time or time off for parents or whatever. I'm just curious. You know,
it may perfectly well. Yeah, it doesn't have to be necessarily something that is related with public expenditures. It may have to do with ways of facilitating community life, for instance, or way of making people trustful, trust each other, and so on. So I think that it can go to a lot of different areas. However, one shouldn't think of public policies as a way of improving people satisfaction with their private lives. I mean, there is a blurring area there where obviously you don't want to interfere.
That's why I'm thinking the areas around it where you can actually create conditions
You just create the conditions, exactly.
Let me ask my second question because I want to get to the audience, and I'll turn to Karen, and maybe Carol can come back in. One of the things that's bothered me about this research over time as we've talked about it is I can see it being used as a smug rationale for inequality. You know, the peasants are happy the way they are. Why improve their lives if you actually, look, if you raise their incomes a little bit, they become more unhappy while you're doing that. And yet, if I understand it right, you know, if you look at that chart with different countries, the countries that are relatively, at least among rich countries, the more egalitarian countries seem to have a higher level of happiness. If I remember right, Denmark and the Netherlands, for example, score quite high on happiness. Is there any sense of inequality, the relationship of the degrees of inequality in a society and happiness levels, and should we worry and think about that?
Well, there are several bodies of research on this. I think one of the things is depends on what inequality signals. So in Europe, inequality makes people slightly less happy, and particularly the poor, which you would expect. In the United States, the only group that's made unhappy by inequality are left-leaning rich people.
yeah, I love that pie there. I forgot that.
It's a bit of a conundrum, but I think it's because in the U.S. we still have this sense that inequality, you know, everybody can be Bill Gates, and inequality is a sign of opportunity, even though the data don't bear it out. Our mobility rates are actually no higher and, in fact, lower than many OECD countries now, which is a change. But what it signals is sort of the public image of it is still what it used to be, a sign of opportunity. In Latin America, meanwhile, where you have actually mobility rates have increased a fair amount, and they're not all that far off of ours, inequality seems to make people makes the poor less happy and the rich happier, because it still signals persistent advantage for the rich and persistent disadvantage for the poor. I think in the findings for the Scandinavian countries, just that they're generally happier, may have something to do with more equitable income distribution. Probably, more importantly, is better public goods, which probably come with more equitable income distribution. But the inequality story is it's a complicated one, and I think it's because of what inequality signals really differs across societies. And then there's also a difference placed on individual effort versus collective outcomes that also differs, for example, between the U.S. and Europe to some extent.
Do you have any thoughts on this inequality
also,
question?
Also, Carol's the expert on how happiness relates to it, but I think it's just, if I can just jump in and just talk about the way you frame the question, I think it's actually really related to this question of why it's not an official statistic right now. I mean, I think, you know, Alan has a really nice set of speeches he's done on the data issue and better government data so government can make better decisions, and he has, you know, he talks about we should have this whole dashboard, you know, we care about growth, but we care about distribution and inequality, and I actually am very supportive of that idea, but I think I think there are two reasons people resist it, and one is that in a way you think, well, we'll just put those all up there and let people weight what they want, you know, people who want to put a lot of weight on growth versus inequality or the left-leaning liberal, whatever Carol was saying, the Democrats.
I think Collins even just praising the IRS.
Even just choosing the set of indicators is, you know, whether you're going to put the commuting times in there is implicitly putting, telling people how we should weight all these different things. And I think that that is one reason there are these objections to the Sarkozy Commission and other efforts like that. I will say what I think the other objection is, all these measurement issues that we've been talking about, that we still really, it's really complicated to measure happiness, and I think we really are not sure if we're doing it right. So,
thank you. This gentleman has wanted to get in right from the beginning. Yes, you, sir. We've got, if you could identify yourself, please, that would be great.
Hi, thank you. I'm the U.S. correspondent of Helsingin Sanomat from the happy-go-lucky Finland.
They're high on happiness, aren't they, the Finns?
Yes. My question, I guess, is to Professor Graham, and it's a pity I didn't bring along the New York Times poll today, but they had a survey on the Tea Party movement. If I'm not mistaken, the Tea Party activists were, or the supporters of the Tea Party movement were wealthier, better educated, but at the same time they felt more negative about the economic conditions of the United States at the moment. So my question to you is, you mentioned before that Republicans tend to be happier than Democrats, but now it seems to me that Republican-leaning parts of U.S. population are unhappier with what's going on in the country. Can you talk about this perhaps discrepancy, and then to what extent in your research globally did the regime in power affect the happiness of
that's
people?
That's a great question. Thank you. And also you can talk a little bit about this Republican-Democrat difference you found.
Well, just generally speaking, and over time, Republicans are happier than Democrats in the U.S. We've even looked at it now during the crisis years and even after the change of government from Republican to Democrat, and we still get Republicans happier than Democrats. So it isn't determined only by what regime is in power. Obviously, the Tea Party movement presumably is a rather extreme movement that's very unhappy with how things are going. Why are Republicans happier than Democrats? I think it's a little bit analogous to a finding that people that have faith are happier than people that don't, at least in places where there's moderate religion. Republicans tend to, this is very much an aggregate, averaged out statement, right? That the system is basically just, and if people work hard, they get ahead, and their rewards are their just rewards, and you really shouldn't mess with it too much. Versus Democrats are more likely to think the system is unfair, at least for some people, or stacked against some people, and it's unjust, and we want to change it and make it better. I think that and we know that believing that things are unjust is linked to unhappiness. In the same way people have faith as sort of, God will take care of it, it will work out, is linked to higher levels of happiness than people that think that maybe things won't work out. Maybe nobody will make it better. So I think the Democrat-Republican finding can be explained to some extent along those lines, but I certainly welcome any other insights on it. In terms of the regime in power, I haven't done extensive work on this. We certainly know people that live in democracies are happier than people that don't live in democracies. We know that people that participate politically are happier than people that don't participate. So there's something about the democratic process that makes people happy. My guess would be that in more, particularly in more repressive contexts, if you are not in the party that's in power, that could produce stronger levels of unhappiness than if you're not in the party that's in power in a system that you know is likely to swing back and forth.
By the way, is it true that all things being equal, wealthier people are happier than poorer people?
Yes.
So that with Republicans, you could have this overlapping thing of income and people of faith, correct? Is that,
although you're controlling for both in the finding.
Right.
So even controlling for income levels and for religiosity,
you still have
Republicans
happier. Because what I was seeing in the Tea Party is, and we need data, you should get Gallup to throw a question on.
Are you a Tea Party member or not?
I'm sorry?
of whether or not you're a Tea Party.
Yeah,
member.
Because the Tea Partiers are seen as seem to be a much more secular part of the conservative movement. And I'd just be very curious if that did or did not affect this level of happiness. Who else? That gentleman to your left, because he's right there. And you won't have to walk, and you'll be happy that way.
Thank you. Thanks for all the presentations. They're interesting. I'm Keith Kosloff. I work on the international side of the Treasury Department, actually. And I just had a kind of a methodological question, in particular the survey question about imagining what's the best possible life you can imagine. And I'm wondering, is it necessary to control for what that life is that people are imagining? And I guess the context for my question is, you know, suppose that I'm a villager in rural India that's completely off the grid, and all I know is, you know, what's in the boundaries of my village. Then all of a sudden the grid comes, and I've got a TV, and I watch Dallas on TV, and I can imagine a much greater life for myself. Does it matter whether the survey was conducted before or after I get my TV and can see those greater possibilities?
Could I ask everybody, I realize I've let this go on too long because I was fascinated by all of you. Could I collect a bunch of questions and then everyone could offer a concluding comment? Let's see, there were right down that row. If people could be brief in their questions and then we can get you all in. Sir, and then the gentleman down the end.
Yes, my name is Suruma. I'm from Uganda. I'm in the African Growth Initiative. And I wanted to ask whether you observed the impact of catastrophic changes on different types of societies or incomes. If there is a serious illness like cancer, or there is a catastrophe like an earthquake or climate change that is really bad, do these things seem to be have an impact, a differential impact on different income groups or different countries, or is it all the same or you have not observed it?
Thank you. And just pass it to that young man who has all his happiness ahead of him from her studies.
My name is Nick Kraft. I'm also with the Africa Growth Initiative. So a lot of the comments that all of you have made sort of point to the idea that people don't really seem to be maximizing happiness or utility, at least not in a measurably consistent way. So thinking about, you know, theoretical economics, how do we continue to go forward with neoclassical models that are based on sort of a maximizing utility assumption? Thanks.
That's a great question. And then could I go to that gentleman back there with the beard, because he's had his hand up a long time, and then we'll – I'm sorry to cut it off. Sir.
I'm Fred Altman in Brookings Sessions. Question I have is – happiness, the way you're defining it, seems to be an aggregate of uncorrelated phenomena such as current mood and long-term reaching long-term goals. What's the advantage of aggregating them?
Thank you. That's a fun question. Who wants to take that on? Who wants to take on the attack on old-fashioned economics, since we had a bunch of economists up here? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, behavioral economics is an important growing branch of economics. You know, it's been recognized. Dan Kahneman won a Nobel Prize for his work on the limits of people's decision making. I think the real challenge for economics is to know when to apply lessons we learned from the psychologists and when to return to reveal preference. And also caution kind of how we define utility, because I don't think happiness is utility. Maybe it's an element in the utility function, along with some of the other emotions that I mentioned before, like spending time in a good mood or not being angry all day long and so on. So I think we need to be careful not to equate our measures of subjective well-being with utility. And at the same time, I think we have to be very careful to define utility in a way that's not tautological, because often the way some of our colleagues in economics define utility, it's impossible to reject. And what I think the work of Kahneman and others has shown is that people will make inconsistent choices depending upon how the way that they're framed. You can change the parameters, and they'll make choices which were not consistent with choices that were in their interest before. So I think it's possible to demonstrate that people don't always behave in correspondence to the axioms that are necessary for utility maximization. But at the same time, I think our measurement of subjective well-being is at a relatively early stage, and I would be very cautious about going too far in the direction of equating well-being with utility.
Could I let Karen and Eduardo take on any of those that they want and then go to you so you could close, since you are a star of our show here? Could I go to Karen and Eduardo on any of those questions?
So I'll just jump in and say, you know, I think Ellen did a nice job of describing the potential, both the sort of potential good that's going to come out of the behavioral research and the complications. I actually think myself that we don't, I'm not a person who believes we need to throw out everything that we've been working with. I just think they're really important. I think if we could have just incorporated cognitive limitations and information costs into and some of this and biases into our standard models, we could have gone a long way towards sort of avoiding what we've been through in the last couple of years.
Eduardo.
Yeah, no, my only reaction to that question about the value of standard economics, given all these developments, I think it's very much in the line of what Alan said. I don't think that we should throw away what we had. What these new developments lead us to is basically to understand phenomena that were important for people's well-being that could not be easily treated with the standard economics. And that's precisely why I see that this area of public goods is so important and so amenable to this approach. Because certainly the way that we economists were trying to approach many of these problems of public goods didn't go any anywhere. They were just approaches that were too convoluted, while this view provides an approach that is very simple, and that really takes you very far. So I think that the toolkit of economics is a very powerful one, and I don't think that is to be discarded with these developments. I think it's going to be complemented with these developments, and I think that there is a strong consensus in the profession about that.
Okay, just quickly, let me echo what everybody said. You know, sort of, you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater on this one, particularly because even though we found a great way to think about things differently and to identify quirks in the way people make choices and all kinds of irrationality, and we also, you know, we still haven't, I don't think, have a lot of questions answered, for example, about, you know, the definition of happiness, how does happiness relate to subjective well-being and all the domains that Alan mentioned, which ones matter more, what definition of happiness do we care about in the policy domain. I mean, so it's a new tool, it's great, but it's not ready to replace everything, and I think it will always be an important complement, but and may make us rethink some of our traditional tools. Just very quickly, two other questions that weren't addressed. On the best possible life question, you know, does it control for access to the media or change? I mean, these surveys are done at particular points in time, and so you're capturing some people that have more information than not, but the overall responses to the best possible life question in the Gallup World Poll, which is, you know, a huge poll across tons of countries, consistently shows a relationship between, you know, having higher levels of wealth and better answers to best possible life. And it suggests to me, and also the work in Afghanistan that I've done suggests to me, when you get differences in those responses, when people are asked the best possible life question in Afghanistan, they score low compared to the world average, and just open-ended happiness, they score high, suggests that even in very poor contexts where people don't have a lot of information, they have enough in today's world to know that the best possible life, you know, is global and is probably not how they're living. And then on catastrophes, yes, a lot of events have catastrophic impact. People adapt to a lot of events, you know, over time, economic crises, Two of the things that people have a hard time adapting to are unemployment, long-term bouts of unemployment, as Alan mentioned. That's something that people seem to never adapt back from. And the other are some forms of serious illness, not all. They adapt to mobility problems better than to illnesses associated with a lot of anxiety, pain, you know, and unpredictability. But people are remarkably adaptable, even in the face of catastrophes.
I want to thank you for a wonderful presentation, a great book. I want to thank all our panelists. The one quotation I hadn't used earlier is one from George Bernard Shaw, who said there are two tragedies in life. One is not to achieve your heart's desire. The other is to achieve it. and I think it shows the conundrum of figuring out happiness. But I suspect that there is more happiness on the in our pursuit of happiness than in ever imagining we'll achieve it absolutely. And I appreciate your help in getting us closer. Thank you all very, very much.